the Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning, and welcome to A View From Afar. And today, we are joined by political scientist Paul Buchanan, and in this episode, we will unpack why the West is losing a strategic deterrence advantage at this juncture against Russian Federation President Vladimir Putin. In this episode, specifically, we will analyse whether deterrence in its various forms is an effective tool against aggressive authoritarian opponents, and especially why NATO and the United States is at a disadvantage at this point when attempting to use deterrence to gain leverage over Putin and the Russian offensive occurring against Ukraine and its peoples. We know about the rules and conventions that prevent NATO and the United Nations, for example, from defending Ukrainians on Ukrainian territory. And last week's episode explored all of those avenues. But what of the responsibility to protect principles? The RTPs, they're designed to defend vulnerable and helpless populations. And in addition, we're going to examine the concepts of shatter and peripheral zones when it comes to war, and why Central Europe is the core shatter zone of past and present global conflict. But before we deep dive into these issues, remember, if you are joining us live via the social media platforms, feel free to comment as we can include your interaction and your questions in this program. So let's cross to Paul, who is waiting online to discuss all of these issues. Good afternoon, Paul. Tēnā koe, eho.
Kia ora, Selwyn. Good afternoon to you and our listeners. Great to be here.
Yeah. Now, Paul, the three main things I thought we would look at today are: how can deterrence be an effective tool against Putin's offensive in Ukraine? The other area we'll look at today are various forms of deterrence realistic when soft power diplomacy fails? And can responsibility to protect principles invoke a humanitarian grounds as a move against Russian aggression? Those are the main ones there, but also some theory around why is Central Europe the core shatter zone of past and present global conflicts. Before we get right into that, I'll just bring up an update for about 1 minute on what Deutsche Welle is reporting overseas overnight New Zealand time on an update on exactly where we are with this offensive that is occurring on Ukrainian soil.
Russia is escalating its attacks across Ukraine. Russian forces are reported to be intensifying fighting in the suburbs of the capital and have also stepped up their bombardment of Kyiv. Emergency services say at least two people were injured in new strikes on the city this morning.
For residents of the Ukrainian capital, every passing day brings further shelling, more homes lost, and more casualties. Is she alive? Yes, she's alive. Get her in the car. A citywide curfew was imposed on Tuesday and will last until Thursday morning. Ahead of the curfew, people rushed to the stores to stock up on food and supplies. The situation in the city is not bad. People are holding up. We're supported by the volunteers and the territorial defense. Meanwhile, President Volodymyr Zelensky said he saw hope for compromise in talks between Russia and Ukraine, even as Moscow stepped up its assault.
It is important. It's difficult, but important, because any war ends in an agreement. Meetings continue. As I'm told, the positions in the negotiations sound more realistic. However, there still needs to be more time for decisions to be in Ukraine's interests.
So, Paul, that's pretty much it in a nutshell. Now, what we've seen, of course, over the last 24 hours, and things move so fast in these areas, don't they, is Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky speaking directly by way of satellite feed to the United States Congress, where right across the aisle, it seems that all people in attendance were standing and applauding his presence there, through the connection. And we saw immediately after the President of the United States, Joe Biden, addressing some of the things that they saw. And some of the things obviously were a plea for assistance in all forms, including what Zelensky was asking for was once again a plea for a no-fly zone to be supported. We saw Biden say, we're not going to do that, but we'll do all of these. And there was a raft of measures of which Biden rolled out. And only a week ago, it was believed that those decisions relating to military hardware, defense hardware, would be would flag an expansion of the conflict. Now it's changed. Is this also with these talks that Zelensky spoke of, and as I understand it, Lavrov, representing the Russian Federation, said there have been some firming up of some parts of an agreement that's happening in there. Is there a danger that at that time, as we've seen in past conflicts going back generations, that when there are ceasefire talks occurring, there's a land grab that's going on militarily? And is this the juncture where deterrence has a possibility of being relevant and real? And has the West got the ability to get ahead of Russia? So there's a lot to unpack there, Paul, but I just wanted to set the scene.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, we've got to unpack the term deterrence. Yep. First, and then, and I'll explain it as briefly as I can. Now, we tend to think of deterrence in terms of the nuclear standoff. And so a lot of people forget that deterrence actually goes all the way down the so-called kill chain. And so let me phrase it this way. Deterrence is basically is a means of forestalling or preventing an opponent from committing some sort of act, some action. Now, it's clear that deterrence failed to prevent the Russians invading Ukraine. So that's the starting point, a failure of deterrence on the part of NATO and the West in general. Now, deterrence has a force component. I'll talk about that in a second. But we have to be very clear here, as a result of this conflict, we may see the emergence of non-force deterrence, particularly financial sanctions that are enforced universally. They can be a powerful deterrent to other would-be invaders. If Russia suffers financially for this adventure, you can be assured that other tyrants will think twice before making a move on their neighbors. But it depends, again, on the effectiveness of the sanctions regime. But I'm thinking, you know, China, although the situation with Taiwan is very different for many reasons, but Taiwan will have to look, China will have to look at this and say, boy, if they can do this to the Russians, we're a little bigger, but we could hurt, you know, be hurt equally badly. Now, on the force side, there's deterrence to prevent wars or to prevent conflicts,
which is what you just—that's what you just spoke to right there. Right?
Yeah, I think that the financial sanctions regimes can be a very effective deterrent down the road in light of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. This is the first time we've really seen globally enforced sanctions, and there's some loopholes and some leaks. But if it proves to be, I would say, even 70-80% effective in shutting down the Russian economy, it will be a deterrent down the road to others who would seek to, you know, imitate Putin when it comes to disputes with their neighbors.
And just leaving to be clear, you're not suggesting that the sanctions to date have had any effect whatsoever on the offensive that Russia has embarked on, but that there is an opportunity for others that may be contemplating a similar kind of thing in the future, or even if it's near future, that it would be folly from the point of view of economic interests, should it do so. That's what, is that paraphrasing?
Exactly, exactly. I wanted to get the future one out of the way first. Again, because deterrence failed in this instance. But I think the financial, you know, the sanctions regime, if effective, will be a deterrent to future aggressors. You know, but, you know, the details are in how effective is it in crippling the Russian economy. But when we get to force, you know, the general belief is that deterrence prevents wars. Well, in this case, it did not. But many people don't realize that there's deterrence within conflicts. So mainly designed to prevent a party to a conflict from escalating into, let's say, chemical weapons or up into nuclear weapons.
So, and even with Putin, sorry to interject there, but I'm just trying to keep like bullet point approach to the definitions of it here. So even with Putin, it seems that he's used deterrence to stop NATO and the West from engaging on the offensive as it plays out. I hate using that word play out, sorry about that, but on Ukrainian soil. So it seems like Putin and the Russian Federation have got ahead of NATO and the West and the United States on this deterrent argument here, by the threat of using chemical.
Yeah, actually, you're ahead of me on that one, because so far, the deterrent has been on the in the Russians' favor. They said, you know, do not get involved. You know, anything you do, we will escalate far beyond what we're doing now. And he's pretty much held NATO in check. I mean, NATO's really sitting there going, well, Ukraine is not a member of NATO, so we're not obliged to help them, that sort of thing, for the first 2 weeks. So he played the deterrence game within the conflict very well. But the tables are turning. And this announcement today that the U.S. is going to supply, you know, Javelin anti-tank missiles, Sidewinder anti-aircraft missiles, that sort of thing, you know, by the thousands. That's going to be a game changer. And I agree with most of the security experts who say a no-fly zone, A, would be provocative, that will, you know, eventually see Russians shooting at Americans or NATO members. But more importantly, it's ineffective. If you have ground-based air defense systems that are robust, you can take out Russian fighters flying over Ukrainian airspace, including the West. And so that's what they're doing. These are defensive weapons. The Russians can't really say that we're introducing offensive weapons into it, but we're introducing them in such quantities that they're going to be a game changer. And Russian armor is seriously at risk as soon as those things get into the field. And here we have to talk about, you know, something that has come up and then tends to subside, which is the presence of foreign fighters on both sides. Now, we know the Russians have brought in Syrians. The Syrians are repaying the favor. So Assad has sent some of his military over to bolster the Russians. We know the Russians have Chechens on their side. But the Ukrainians have this internationalist movement, you know, very similar to the Spanish Civil War in that regard. And that internationalists, mostly veterans from Canada, the United States, the UK, I mean, all over the place, are coming. They know how to use those weapons, and they are going to be enlisted into the Ukrainian military, which of course makes them subject to the Geneva Convention. And but they will have, you know, American training, British training. A lot of these guys have been in recent wars, so they don't fear the Russian tanks. You know, they're itching for a fight, and you give them this sort of weaponry, that is going to counter the Russian advantage when it comes to offensive operations. Now, that's where I think deterrence is going to hold. Putin now has to face the fact that if he moves or tries to cross the Dnieper River, if he tries to take Western Ukraine, he's going to encounter the type of resistance that will force him to do one of two things, retreat or escalate. The escalatory ladder, as it's called, leads to very serious problems of command and control over weapons of mass destruction. Now, we know that the Russian missile forces are under a different command and control complex than are the artillery that would shoot chemical or biological weapons. The controls over the latter are much looser. They were used. I mean, these weapons were used in Syria the same forces that use them in Syria are now in the Ukraine. So we have to look very carefully at cornering the Russians to the point that they may want to get involved with using those weapons. But you mentioned it early, and this is where this deterrent is both of force and of politics. You mentioned the responsibility to protect.
Yep.
I would assume that that should be invoked now, that the vulnerable population of the Ukraine needs to be protected by the international community. They appear
so what would that waiting. What would that look like? What would that look like?
Well, it would allow them to invoke not the NATO charter, but countries to make decisions to put troops into the Ukraine, or at least reinforce them in the West. You could leave the frontline fighting to the internationalists and the Ukrainians, but bring all that logistical support that is available throughout the West so as to bolster. Remember, armies run, you know, run on their meals, you know, you need food, you need all that sort of thing. If that burden was taken away from the Ukrainians and allowed them to fight and start begin counteroffensives against the Russians in and around Kiev and further to the east, then you've basically, you've not only halted the Russian offensive, but you now have opened space for more serious negotiations. Because at the end of the day, if you deter him in conflict, having not deterred Putin from starting the war, you can deter him from escalating the war to an untenable conclusion, in which case you've opened now space for a more serious dialogue about how to end this particular stalemate. And you can see the opening already in that the Ukrainians have said that NATO membership is off the table. So that's their concession right there. They've said, you know, that means Putin has got what he wants in terms of NATO. Now he says he wants to demilitarize the Ukraine. That's not going to happen, not after this.
Yeah.
And so I think what we're seeing here is the materialization, if you will, of a deterrence within conflict concept that's based on the supply of an overwhelming amount of defensive weaponry that can counter the Russian advance and yet still leave it below the threshold of having to escalate into weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah. Over the last 24 hours also, we have seen representatives of NATO nations, significant among them, there are three leaders from Europe, right? So significant among them is Polish leader there, Polish president. And they have been down to Ukraine and they have committed their support. It appears from what we're getting out of that from a media point of view on the principles of the responsibility to protect. And also in tandem to that, we have seen coverage in the significant media outlets like Deutsche Welle, for example, in Germany and others across Europe, where they are actually pushing an examination of this RTP, if we want to put it into an acronym kind of sounding thing there. Do you believe that now it is right? I know that some of the US generals in the United States are saying we've got, it may be a 3-day window, it may be a week, but you don't know. It's a narrow window for NATO-led military to step up its game. And perhaps I, rather than paraphrase it, I'll just pull in a couple of things here that are really quick examples of this. And here we've got one. He's the 13th, as he put it, the 12th supreme commander of the European force representing NATO. And this is the United States general here speaking. I'll just bring this on now. Sorry, I just got a little bit of a delay there.
Right now, and ship parts to Ukraine, and Ukraine uses those parts on their own 29s. I think we've been far too timid on the support that we're giving to the Ukrainians, and if we don't stand up to Putin, it's going to get worse. It's not going to stop Ukraine. It's going to go on to the NATO countries. And so that's a problem.
Now that's General
Rilov. If I could turn it over to you for a two-finger right.
just bring that sound down. That was General Ralston, obviously formerly a specialist in commanding issues relating to Europe. We've also got coming up there as well, Paul.
Now, I was actually going to ask.
Sorry about those sound things. We've got Wes Clark, former general, in the same capacity as well, and he has been very prominent in the United States, and he is saying the same thing, and he's eloquently kind of pushing a real strong case for a military response, NATO-led, United States obviously prominent among them. And once again, his key words were, the Western forces have been too timid in presenting a deterrence face toward the Russian Federation on this issue. If we look at from the point of view of that, do we see, as they are saying, and this reportage was coming through from the Centre for International Studies, Security and International Strategic and International Studies in the United States, where they had four of those four-star generals on a panel overnight New Zealand time, pretty much all saying the same thing. Do we see that this situation here now is like what we're talking about with the right, the responsibility to protect, and that that gets NATO in on this in a much more forward-stepping way? It may not be a no-fly zone, but whatever shape it may take that you think represents what they are saying. If these retired generals are saying it, we can understand most significantly that most probably Biden's most significant general, Miley, is saying a similar thing. If that's not correct, can you explain why that would be the case? And do you believe that we are at a situation like Bill Clinton faced when there was the problems in the Balkan states and NATO, with the United States and forward-footing this in the end, with the UK giving pressure from behind, initiated the bombing of Serbia and Kosovo, and in particular the bombing of Belgrade and Serbia. So, Paul, so there's a whole situation. I just wanted to map out there and then get you speaking to those points.
The Serbian situation was very different because Russia was not in a position to defend Serbia, and they were using responsibility to protect as the justification for the Allied bombing of the Serbs. But let me get back a little bit, just so people are aware. You realize, Selwyn, that the West isn't standing idly by. I'll give you an instance. I am pretty sure, based on my background, that Western submarines are in the Mediterranean and are tailing Russian warships. These submarines have cruise missiles that can reach Russia. I would imagine that even off Vladivostok in the North Pacific, there are American subs close in on the naval bases in Eastern Russia. I mean, this game is a big game. And the Russians know it. I mean, they understand that if push comes to shove, the shoving coming from the West is going to be disastrous for them. So, you know, it's a multi-layered checkerboard, if you will. And already maneuvering has occurred with a lot of signaling to the Russians that they need to temper their ambitions in the face of this resistance. Now, we said it last week, you got to give Putin an out, and the out is going to come from that negotiating table. But you've got to get him to stop his advance. And to do that, you deter him from escalating and expanding the war further. He can't move to the West. I think that river is the red line, if you will, for the West. If he starts moving to try to take Western Ukraine, then I think you're going to see NATO get involved because he's running right up to NATO member countries.
Okay, do you... Sorry, Paul, on that point, do you see Kiev, for example, as being in West Ukraine?
No, I don't, although it's the demarcation point. If Kiev falls, then it opens the floodgates, if you will, for a Russian move into the Western Ukraine. Now, mind you, and we've talked about this before, the Russians may occupy Western Ukraine, but then they're going to get bogged down in a guerrilla war, and the Ukrainian resistance will be fueled by the West, by NATO, right up along those borders. It's going to be impossible for the Russians to hold the entirety of Ukraine for any length of time, short of, you know, unleashing tactical nuclear weapons, which again, they don't want to do, because the retaliation will be such that Russia will never be the same. So that's just it. There are thresholds that the Russians understand. I think that NATO is going to get involved one way or another. And I think that where it might get involved, and you and I on a private aside made some commentary about this, they're going to try to establish humanitarian corridors to allow refugees to exit without getting bombed, but also to facilitate the flow of not only weapons, but humanitarian supplies into the Ukraine. And the no-go zone will be attacking those humanitarian corridors. If the Russians attack the humanitarian corridors, then the West, not NATO, can invoke the responsibility to protect. Let me point out, just so we understand what R2P means, the R2P is not an international law. It's an international convention that was developed after the genocide in Rwanda, where the world just sat and watched, did nothing.
Literally.
The Canadians introduced it in the aftermath of the Rwandan massacres. And it basically says that the international community is obliged to come to the defense of vulnerable populations when they're being attacked. It's as simple as that. It was invoked with regards to Libya during and after the fall of Gaddafi. Now, unfortunately, there's been manipulation of the R2P by Western nations, you know, justifying it, but what they really were interested in was regime change in Libya. And that was most unfortunate. In the Ukraine, there is a valid argument to be made that you don't need NATO to invoke Article 5. What you need are Western countries of their own accord to invoke the responsibility to protect, then join forces together in that common venture and move into Ukraine, again, to support the humanitarian efforts and protect the defenseless population. The Ukrainians can be left to fight and be supplied by the West. I think that's where we're going to go. I think that now that the United States has committed these defensive weapons to the Ukrainians, other countries are going to step up. And in the measure they do, they're going to turn the tables on the Russians. Think about it from the Russians' point of view. As they're losing tanks, as they're losing armor, they're going to have to redeploy land assets from the Far East, you know, from other areas. And of course, that leaves them vulnerable in those areas. They do not want to do that. They want to, you know, be able to accomplish their goals with the 200,000 troops that they have on their disposal. Now, with the movement of these weapons into the Ukraine on the part of the U.S. and its allies, you know, that cost-benefit equation starts to shift dramatically. So, again, that points to start steering the Russian nose towards the negotiating table in a way that so far they haven't been. And I think in that measure, the decision was very good, but I still believe that they're going to have to invoke R2P in order to get, you know, a fuller, if you will, a more robust Western presence in Western Ukraine.
Okay, so once again, we mentioned earlier on that the United States Congress was addressed by Ukraine's President Zelensky. And in that was a very passionate call for assistance. Obviously, we mentioned earlier on the no-fly zone, of which has been excluded, but he's got what he wanted. If you were talking about other military defensive hardware assistance from the United States and hard cash to be able to sustain this defensive situation, it looks like he's got it. The other thing that was significant in that speech is he asked the Congress members to watch a video that they'd put together of the reality of what it is like for his population as a consequence of the Russian invasion. And the Congress there was witness then to close-up video of the reality of children being wounded, children that were dead, limp on stretchers, limbs blown off, civilian populations desperate and calling out for help. and a country that seems to be still functioning and being able to at least attempt to address and to assist. And then once again, he comes back and he asks for assistance in those areas. I'll just at that point, because simultaneously almost to this, just a few hours difference, and I mentioned earlier on, we had, which is a very well-known United States General, Wes Clark, who was a specialist up, was, you know, in his career, probably the pinnacle, would it be correct to say, was his positions in Europe. And this is what he had to say, and we'll just bring this and kick this off now.
We haven't respected that. We need to be taking greater risk, and I'm going to go from something Phil said earlier, and also what Joe has said.
We've been excessively intimidated.
We don't know what red lines are because we don't want World War III, but can we do more?
Absolutely.
I keep getting reports of things that are in the pipeline, but there's a lawyer somewhere, this is hung up there.
And I hear the reports of all this going in.
When I talk to people in Ukraine, they don't have it.
So where is it?
Is it in Poland?
Is it still stuck up in the Russian bureaucracy?
How's it going to get in there?
And we've got a very narrow window.
If we don't provide additional assistance very quickly.
To keep the corridor of reinforcement and resupply open into Kyiv.
Now, on that last point there, Paul, that brought to mind when you were talking about what you saw in the next few days, perhaps firming up, is those humanitarian corridors, and that's what he seems to be talking about, but direct military NATO-led activity that would assert that. I just wanted to bring that up now because I just wanted you to have the time and the opportunity to explain that part more and how you would see that shape up, if indeed it does shape up in that respect.
Well, let's first of all, I didn't mention this earlier, but it's important. You would have seen the coverage of the missile strike on the Ukrainian military base that was 10 kilometers from the Polish border.
Yes.
I'll be honest with you, that was a legitimate military target for the Russians. You know, there was a lot of, you know, uproar that the Russians attacked so close to Poland. But that's a staging area for those very internationalists that I talked about earlier, and it's a weapons depot. So under the laws of war, it was a legitimate target. And we need to be conscious of that, because the humanitarian corridors cannot, you know, be dual use. They can't be military corridors and humanitarian at the same time. So I would imagine you get the International Red Cross involved, and they establish these corridors, you know, based upon, you know, what the Ukrainians think is the best way to deliver humanitarian services and get refugees out. That's all fine. The thing that seems to be emerging is a consensus amongst Western military people that the Russians aren't all that competent, that they deluded themselves into thinking that this was going to be quick and easy. And you've had, I mean, think of it this way. They've now lost four generals in the fighting in 3 weeks. Four generals. Normally, generals lead from behind. They're not in the lead tank. And yet, because of problems with morale, problems with command and control and communications, generals are having to get out and lead. I mean, the old-fashioned, you know, guy on horseback leading his troops, they're having to do that, and they get killed. Well, when they die, it is literally a decapitation of that command and control structure. Western military analysts are saying, you know, this is not sustainable from the Russians' point of view, especially now that this defensive weaponry is going into the Ukraine. There's going to be unlimited amounts of javelins and stingers coming the Russians' way now that Biden has opened the spigot. The Russians, on the other hand, they're financially strapped. It is not an unlimited supply of tanks and whatever else they have on that side. So it forces them into that conundrum. Do we escalate and try to get this over using banned weapons, or do we sit down at that table and cut our losses and go back home? Now, Putin, of course, he's in trouble already. I mean, when a guy gives a speech where he starts talking about traitors and fifth columnists inside of Russia, you know he's worried about something. But what you want to do is separate Putin from the rest of his command structure. You know, I would say to the generals, look it, I'm not going to blame you. You're taking orders the way you're supposed to. It's the guy on the top who's got to go. And so, you know, you can play this multi-layered chess game in many different ways, but I really think in the last 24 hours, we've seen a turning of the table where now Russians have to calculate that they're going to face an enemy that is bolstered by these internationalists and is endlessly supplied with, again, defensive weapons. So you can't argue that the Ukrainians have escalated. They're just defending better. And I think that'll drive them to the table. There's still maybe weeks of fighting to continue because they have objectives in the south that appear to be achievable. And those objectives, including recognition of the annexation of Crimea, are quite feasible in terms of a negotiated settlement. But right now, the land war is being prosecuted at a slower and slower pace, while the resupply of the Ukrainians is now increasing at a very rapid pace. So I think that if you invoke the responsibility to protect, you get the International Red Cross involved to open humanitarian corridors, then you can isolate the Russians in terms of what they are going to do with, you know, these developments in front of them, and you provide them the escape offered by the negotiating table to recognize the legitimacy of their claim that Ukraine should be neutral, shouldn't be a NATO member. I mean, those are things that are already being conceded. So that's the out that we talked about last week. You know, the Russians are being given an out, and they can save some face if they take what's being offered to them. If they persist, they will be defeated. I mean, they will be defeated. And that may take a long time, but, you know, there's nothing in it for the Russians at this point other than cutting their losses and cutting whatever deal is offered to them now, because anything down the road, if they continue on this path, will result in a lesser deal for them. In fact, I would argue if they're defeated on the battlefields of the Ukraine, Ukraine will become a NATO member. I mean, that'll be one of the aftermaths as Ukraine becomes a full-throated NATO member. The Russians, I think, you know, need to understand this now. And the announcement by Biden about this defensive weaponry clearly is going to raise eyebrows in the Kremlin, because now it's becoming a much more even fight.
Now, just quickly before we get to the last question relating to shatter zones in Europe and why that is such an important issue for the whole world, if we just conclude, do you think Wes Clark is correct that the West has been too timid in creating a situation of realistic deterrence against the United States, the Russian Federation?
Yeah, but I agree with them to a point, but it was timidity born of caution. You know, the West looks at the invasion, and we all understood that in the beginning, it was going to be a form of blitzkrieg, a form of shock and awe that was supposed to be over in 48 hours. You know, seize Kiev, overthrow the regime, install a puppet, done and dusted. When the resistance on the part of the Ukrainians rose to the level that it has risen, the West sat back and looked at this and thought, you know, there's a lot more to the Ukrainians than we would have thought. And so they were cautious because they wanted the Ukrainians to be able to fight on their own, you know, not get involved, not get dragged into this. The Ukrainians can fight to a standstill against the Russians. And of course, a tie goes to the weaker actor in any conflict. So if the Ukrainians can slow them to a halt, then they are going to win. You know, the political outcome will be in their favor. I think what's happened is, as this is grinding down and slowing down, it's like a fire. When a fire slows down, it burns more intensely where it is. That's the dangerous part. Right now, it's becoming, you know, a meat grinder. in the cities where the Russians are trying to advance. And they're advancing very slowly. So the civilian casualty count is going through the roof. You know, they're no longer able to, you know, run rapidly at will throughout the country. It is at that point where the West says, okay, we've got a humanitarian crisis now. The Ukrainians are defending themselves, but by slowing the advance, they're making the human tragedy much more worse. I mean, they got to do it. They got to slow the Russians, but in doing so, the humanitarian disaster that is the Ukraine is getting worse. You invoke the responsibility to protect. So I don't think they were timid. They were cautious because the Ukrainians were doing a good job. But now they realize in doing a good job, they've actually made the humanitarian crisis worse because the Russians are now, you know, basically, you know, using war of annihilation tactics in civilian areas. Those are war crimes, of course, and someone may have to pay for them down the road. But I think that it wasn't so much timidity as it was an overabundance of caution, but that, quite frankly, appears to have ended, perhaps because of Zelensky's speech. But I also think this has been in the works for a while. It takes a while to coordinate a resupply and logistics effort of the magnitude that we're seeing here. It's now being put into play. And I think we're going to see some rather dramatic developments on the battlefields within the next few days. And that, as I keep on saying, will eventually force the Russians to be more honest when they conduct negotiations.
Okay, we'll talk about the shatter zones and peripheral zones, but we'll just leave a couple of Wes Clark's comments relating to bureaucracy holding back the necessity for timeline expediency here, relating to getting things done and equipment up there. We'll look at that at another juncture should it become an issue that needs to be analysed. But Paul, the last part here is, why is Central Europe the core shatter zone of past and present global conflict? And within this, why the globe, all countries and all citizens of the planet actually need to take heed and to find ways to ease this situation in Ukraine off the realities of what is occurring, to stop the atrocities.
Yeah, it's been pretty amazing. I mean, this is the core of geopolitical thought, at least modern geopolitical thought, for the last two centuries. Geopolitical thought holds that the world is divided into shatter zones and peripheral zones. The shatter zones are those areas where the great powers come into conflict directly. So during the Cold War, it was Central Europe. You know, the idea is the last thing you want are Americans and Russians killing each other directly. Peripheral areas are where surrogates, clients, and even the great powers themselves can engage in conflict, but they're not existential conflicts. So when the U.S. arms some group in Africa and the Russians arm another group in Africa, those groups fight each other as proxies, but Russians and Americans do not. What we have here is a return to the most, you know, the most essential core geopolitical principle in the world for the last two centuries, which is major war in Central Europe. We now have the specter of Americans and Russians killing each other. The Russians may wind up killing Poles and even Germans before they get to the Americans, but that specter puts a ceiling on some of the escalation that can occur, because if Russians and NATO members get into conflict directly, then you have the possibility of at least a tactical nuclear war. And nuclear war, you can, many people will say, well, that'll solve the problem because you'll have some tactical nuclear exchanges. The winner will be determined and it'll shorten the lifespan of the war. Unfortunately, it's going to shorten, you know, much more than the lifespan of the war. You know, any place that gets radiated is going to be non-viable for a long, long time. So the idea here is that you avoid conflicts in the shatter zones. Ukraine is as close to the shatter zone as you can get. The good news, I think, unless Putin really has lost his mind, is that the Russians as well as the West are well aware of this. They understand what happens if this spills into Poland. Because that, if you look at the way this is playing out, if a NATO member was to get involved, it'd be more likely than not to be Poland that gets involved. And the Poles have no love for the Russians or the Belarusians, for that matter. And yet they're sitting up, you know, right up close to them. So I think that there is a conflict avoidance theory going around here, which is we're going to contain it to the Ukraine. And the outcome will be the Ukraine will wind up being a buffer of some sort between NATO and Russia. But we're going to try to contain it, because if it spills further afield, then you have the possibility of a major regional war. And if you have a major regional war in Europe, you can be assured that it will become a global conflict in a short matter of time. So right now we're seeing the reemergence of traditional geopolitical conceptualizations of the world. And strangely enough, it's once again Central Europe that is the core of this. Now, I would argue there are now other shatter zones in the world. I would say that, East Asia, Southeast Asia, if you get the Chinese and the Americans in direct conflict, you have the possibilities of a major regional war. And now it's increasingly obvious that the Russians and the Chinese have some sort of bargain where each supports the other, however covertly. And so once one gets in a big way like that, the other one is going to enter as well. And so I think everybody is cognizant of this. I think everybody realizes if the Americans and Russians start killing each other in Europe, the Chinese are going to have to make a move. They've given assurances to the Russians of some sort. And if that happens, then, you know, all I can say is that you and I are very lucky to be sitting in the South Pacific, far away from the battlefields of the North. But let's just hope that, you know, the idea of the shatter zone is sort of puts a natural break or a natural limit on the escalatory potential of the Ukrainian conflict.
Mm. A couple of situations there that come to rise is with respect to China. In last week's program, we detailed how ascendant powers are more reticent to engage into direct conflict, and that might be a positive with respect to China. It may covertly, as you said, support the Russian Federation on the basis of, well, we want to have business with this particular client type of ethos, but with respect to its own interests geopolitically, geoeconomically, geosecurity-wise, it would appear as an ascendant power. It's not its advantage in the long and even in medium term. The other concerning thing from my point of view is if Ukraine becomes a buffer zone between NATO forces and the Russian Federation, that what does that look like? And I kind of think of on the Korean Peninsula, and I've been there myself to the north and south border at Panmunjom. It's not a pretty place to be, and it's not a pretty place for people to try and endure their life's purpose. On that point, let's conclude the program, Paul, and thanks again for your company and your expertise in these areas and for unpacking such complexity once again for the audience. And for those that are been here live, thank you very much for your attendance, and also for those that are joining this podcast on demand, we thank you for that as well, and we look forward to bringing you another program at this time next week, and that would be midday Thursday New Zealand time, which comes to the evening on Wednesday evening United States Eastern time. Thank you, and we look forward to your company once again. Goodbye.